Thank you so much, Dave, and all of you, for coming to church today. It would have been a lonely thing if I'd walked in here and this place was empty. It is a very surreal moment for me, and I think probably for other members of my family, Amy chief among them, to be marking a significant milestone in our journeys and in the life of our church family. It feels like it wasn't all that long ago that this journey began. I remember vividly, it was on the 21st of January, 1997, that Amy and I got off the plane from San Diego with our son, Rush, who was just four, and with Cole, who was 10 months old at the time. And we looked around and we thought to ourselves, wow, it's cold here. It's really cold here in Chicago. And truthfully, the way you warmed us up, the way this community of faith put their arms around us, held on to us, encouraged us, companioned us through all of the seasons of life, warmed us from the center of our beings in a marvelous way. And it was really in your arms and the graceful arms of God that hold us all, that we grew up into being the strapping family that we are now. And we are just so immensely grateful for all of that. Our family has become better because we've been bonded to the DeBoer clan as well. And we're thrilled at that. We wanted some Dutch blood in our family. And we knew that would make us stronger, and we have been so blessed by that friendship also. This coming Tuesday, which will be exactly 28 years to the day that we arrived here, we will set sail for the sunshine again. Not to San Diego, but to Key Largo this time. And we will follow God's call to the next stage of our adventure with Him, as you will enter into the next wonderful part of your journey in the plan of God for His glory and for the blessings that He wants to unleash in all of us and through all of us to the world. And I know you are in great hands with my brother Steve Carter and with the marvelous leaders of our staff and our elder and trustee boards. So I couldn't be more confident in the future of this church. I do remember venturing off to college when I was 18 years old, feeling a little less confident, as many of us do in that season of life. I arrived on the campus of this university, pretty sure I was the error in the admissions process, that I wasn't up to the challenge of life at that university. And I recall being enfolded by a number of great people who lived in the area that I lived in, and they invited me out to come experience the resources of the campus. And one particular night, they took me out to what was called a film society, and we had numerous ones of these in college. And I had a chance to watch for the very first time an old black and white film called Casablanca. Raise your hand if you've ever seen Humphrey Bogart, Ingrid Bergman in that magnificent film. It is one of the most marvelous dramas and love stories, and if you've not yet had a chance to take it in, I want to encourage you to do that. But one of the things I most cherished from the movie was the song. You remember the song? I was reading in Wikipedia recently that indicates that the theme song from Casablanca is second only to Somewhere Over the Rainbow as the number one musical theme of motion pictures through the past century. And some of you will know this song. I'm not going to sing it to you, but you will remember the words of this song, and they go like this. You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is still a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by. I want to think with you about those ideas. And I want to think about it in the frame of reference with which I came to it when I was just 18. Because when I was feeling a little uncertain about the future, there was something deeply comforting to me to think that there actually were fundamental things that would apply in my life and enable me to find an even more meaningful and secure life if I knew what those things were and put them into application. What are the fundamental things? What are the basic realities on which you and I can reliably build our identity and establish assurance as we travel through the ups and the downs of life that are always out there? What are the fundamental things that are as valuable to the 8-year-old as to the 18-year-old or to the 80-year-old? What are those fundamental things? Well, let me try to post on your door frame, if I may, just a few thoughts about that before I go. I do not know exactly how many babies that I've baptized over the years. I think it's probably been more than 10. There have been Sundays up here where I've wanted a super soaker to kind of handle all the babies that God has brought into the life here. What I'm sure of is that I've always wanted those children to absorb, like water sinking into thirsty pores, a certain reality, a certain fundamental experience. I have wanted each and every one of those children to know you are loved. You are loved. Not just sentimentally, not just conditionally, not just occasionally, but absolutely loved. And the desire to pass on that the treasure of that experience, that sense of identity, is what I'm always trying to get across every time I baptize one of those little children. It's what's inside of that Lion King move you see me make, you know, with the children as I raise them up. For all the world to see and look into their eyes. It's what I'm wanting them to feel as I hold them in my arms or as I kiss them on the forehead and say, welcome to the family. Or as I sometimes will take them in my arms and walk them around the congregation so that you can meet them and they can see you, their church family, and sense in the earliest days of their lives, there is this love that enwraps my life. We've got a lot of problems in our world today. You're no stranger to this. You know of the pollution and the poverty and the political partisanship and so many other problems that don't begin with the letter P, but are every bit as significant. You know how distracted we are as a people today, how so often we are unable to even focus on building real relationships or discerning the most important things, because we are bombarded by so much stimulation, so much information, so much fragmentation, always coming at us. And yet I would suggest to you that the number one problem of our time is none of these things. And you've heard me say this before, and I want to say it one final time in hopes that it will be remembered. I think it was Soren Kierkegaard who made this observation, that the chief problem confronting humanity is that we have forgotten with what a great love we have been loved. And this impulse to help us remember that, to take it into us like living water, refreshing us from the center on out, was the inspiration behind some of the music selection that we heard today. To take in the wonder of the great God who's loved us so sacrificially and so profoundly and so perseveringly. We have an oversupply of the devil's kind of love in our age. We have the shallow, evaporating self-love, the narcissistic kind of love in incredible supply in our time, the kind that comes from trying to perpetually splash our faces with the sort of love that comes through the likes and the followership of human beings, many of whom we don't even like and don't really follow ourselves. But we need the kind of love that truly changes us, like a plant in the desert is changed when the spring rains find its roots. We need this kind of life-giving love, this life-changing love that God alone is the ultimate source of. I think that if we knew when we were kids out on the play yard and some person coming along was unkind to us or bullying us, I think that if we could have sensed at that point in our lives that this is a person that probably didn't get the love they needed, but we had, it would have altered our response perhaps. We would have been a little less prone to being injured by the harsh words and treatment of that person. If we knew when we were teenagers that the awkwardness that we were experiencing at that moment and season of life was really only the chrysalis stage of a God who had purposely designed life in such a way that we would have to strive and we would have to stretch and we would have to break free of the old self and build it in that way, the strength needed to really fly in life. If we understood that even the difficult things of life are often mysteriously part of the plan of a loving God for us. If, as we move through the journey of life, that those people that we are inclined to dislike or even outright hate, or whose hungers we are inclined to ignore as we go along, if we knew that they too are beloved with the same great heart that loves us, then maybe it would have altered and would still alter the way that we treated them. This was, of course, the message of Dr. King. This is what he wanted us to see, that we are in this together, that we are under the embrace of a great and loving Heavenly Father, and that we are all his children. If the diagnosis was cancer, and we knew that on the other side of life's door was not, in fact, a brick wall, was not, in fact, a yawning, senseless, cold, dark vacuum. If we knew that on the other side of that threshold was a love so good, so powerful, that it could take the most broken things, the most lifeless things, and raise them to new life more glorious than anything they'd ever been before, I think we might mourn differently. I think we might mourn as those who live with hope. So I think a lot of things would get better if we could be truly washed and immersed in a very, very great love. And so I'm going to tell you a little secret I don't know I've passed on before, but when I am alone in my office after the service is over and I'm signing the baptismal certificate for these children that we baptize up here, I jot down beneath my signature a scripture verse, a citation. I don't know if you can read it on that slide there, but it reads Ephesians 3, verses 14 through 21. Ephesians 3, 14 through 21. Maybe I'm optimistic. I'm prone to it. But I am hoping that long after the water is dry on the foreheads of these children, and I'm not there anymore, the children's parents might see this certificate. They might read that text to themselves first, and then over time seek to impart its wisdom into the life of the child that they're raising, helping them to understand in coming years the wonder of what that text is seeking to convey. I'm hoping that maybe one day when that child is a middle schooler wondering about their worth in life, or maybe a college student far from home, anxious about the future, or maybe in old age someplace, feeling failing faculties and the concern of the growing shadows of life, I'm just hoping and praying that maybe they'll stumble across the baptismal certificate someplace. And they'll note the little handwritten scripture citation. And they'll reach for some Bible that's been lying neglected too long upon the shelf. And they'll blow the dust off. And they'll open it up. And they'll find these words for themselves. And take them in. For this reason, says Paul. For this reason I kneel before the Father. And you need to know that in the text just prior to this, what Paul has been meditating on is the wondrous gift of salvation and that magnificent grace of God. For this reason I kneel before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth derives its name. In other words, if you ever feel alone, if you ever feel forgotten, and all of us at some moments we feel these things, then remember that you are part of a massive family spanning the heavens and the earth across space and time, and you have a Father whose love is so glorious, whose love for you is so magnificent that he chose to send his own son to die in your place and mine, that we might go free, that we might become one of his family afresh. As my friend Victor Warren says, when I really take that in, it is knee-bending. For this reason, I kneel before the Father, from whom every family in heaven on earth derives its name. And I pray that out of his glorious riches, God may strengthen you with power. What we're missing so often in our time is the power to really live to our full potential. The power to rise beyond the circumstances that oppress us. A power that cannot be mustered by our own self-will, cannot be conveyed to us by the gift of money or possessions. We need a power in our spirit, through his spirit in our inner being, so that Christ may dwell in your heart through faith. And I pray that you, being rooted and established in love, in other words, I pray that this love will become for you the ground of your being and your behavior. That it won't just be something you occasionally plugged into and pull out of, but something that is a daily reality out of which your whole life grows and lives. I pray for that, that the nourishing soil of God's love will bring forth in you amazing fruit. And I pray that you may have power to grasp how wide and long and high and deep is the love of Christ. And to know this love, and that means not just to sort of have it bounce off our heads, but to know it almost in the sense of intimacy, to know this love that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled to the measure of all of the fullness of God, that it might overflow your life in glorious ways. This is one of the fundamental things. This love is one of the fundamental things that apply, whether we're a crying child struggling to be in church, or whether we're sitting at home in our living rooms, or whether we're walking through some other part of life, as we all do. And I hope that over the years, if I've done nothing else, I hope I've been able to help you to absorb just a little bit more with what a great love you are loved. There's a second fundamental thing that I want to impress upon you before I go, and it's this. Truth transforms. Truth transforms us. If you want to grow to your God-given potential, if you want to help your kids, your friends, others grow to their full potential, you need love and you need truth. I say that, I want to recognize at the same time that there's been a lot of debate and discussion and musing in our time over whether anybody really can determine what is true. And on one level, I understand that. We've been lied to a lot in our world. We've put our faith in people sometimes who have betrayed our trust. It's hard to find news today that is not selective or slanted to push some ideology of one kind or another. I think even Christians fall prey to this. I think it's important that we always enter into conversations with others with curiosity, with humility, with deep respect for the sacredness of another created in the image of God. And yet that is different than saying, oh, there's no way to determine what's true. In their bestseller, The Day That America Told the Truth, the secular marketing firm of Patterson and Kim found that a stunning 93% of those surveyed declared, and I quote, that they and nobody else determine what is and what isn't moral in their lives. They base their decisions on their own experience and on their daily feelings. Now, can you imagine applying this same standard to other areas of our life beyond mere morality? How long would you continue to fly with an airline whose motto was, safety standards are fine for those who are uptight about that? But our engineers are not so narrow. Or how eager would you be, perhaps, to have your kids at a school where the chemistry teacher said to your daughter, you're free to drink from either one of those beakers of clear liquid. That one's got H2O in it. This one has H2SO4 in it. You just pick the one you like, the one you've got a taste for. Not explaining, of course, that H2SO4 is, what is that, Cole? Sulfuric acid. Yes, my chemistry son can tell you that. But after all, they're both clear liquids. What's one little molecule here and there? How long would you be eager to keep entrusting your child to the care of a steward like that? How excited would you be to go under the scalpel of a surgeon? And my brother Tori, a surgeon sitting up here, this illustration's for him. If the surgeon said, you know, I never bothered that much with anatomy classes. Since all bodies are sort of relative, and all medical knowledge is sort of relative anyway. There is empirical truth. There are discoverable realities. And it's okay to debate and discuss the edges of those things. But there are fundamental things about life that keep applying. There's objective, empirical reason behind the reliability of the Bible, the historicity of Jesus, the resurrection of Christ. I would not have done what I've done over all these years if I did not have very strong belief in the truth of these things. I've never checked my brain at the door when I walked into a church, and neither of you. But the truth that matters every bit as much as empirically validating things is what happens when someone chooses to move beyond their own daily experiences and their own daily feelings, and they choose to trust and to obey Jesus on the moral level. There is something transformative that happens when truth stops being a proposition and starts to be a matter of participation. I think of the longshoreman who came to faith in Jesus Christ and began to talk about his newfound faith and the ways that God was altering life for him to his peers. And one person he met along the waterfront asks him if he really believes all that stuff in the Bible. And he says, I believe that stuff. I really believe that stuff. And the guy, skeptical guy, says, you even believe that stuff about changing water into wine? You really believe that stuff? And the longshoreman had frankly never read that part of the Bible. He hadn't gotten there yet. He said, I don't know about changing water into wine. But I know that in my house, Jesus has changed beer into furniture. Jesus makes a really bold claim to us. He says, I am the way. And he uses the definite article there. I am the way. I am the truth. I am the life. And what he goes on to tell us in John's gospel, and you'll discover this in the marvelous series that Steve is going to lead us into in coming weeks, he says to us that if we do the things that he's instructed us to do, if we actually practice the truths, apply the fundamental things, you will know the truth, like Paul wanted us to know it. You will know the truth, and the truth will actually set you free. You will discover the reliability of the things that I've said to you, and it will open up horizons for you and unchain limits for you. When I was a 18-year-old, and I had just, again, gone to college, I had just started following Jesus. You've heard that story before, and I won't belabor it, but I was skeptical still about so many things. There were a lot of things that Jesus told me to do that were sort of contrary to my feelings or to the things I'd thus far experienced in life. He said crazy things. Jesus said, if you want to really lead, become a servant of people. If you want to be wealthy in the very best way, give generously of yourself. If you seek to make a real dent on your enemies, do good to them and pray for them. Don't run away from mourning, said Jesus. Deny self, and you'll become a greater self. These were counterintuitive things. These were not the world's truths. And yet, having sought over the years, always imperfectly, to apply these fundamental things in my life, I know them to be true. I know the power of his truth. And my life has been set free in inestimable ways. How about you? How about you? The beloved British author and intellectual G.K. Chesterton once wrote, "The problem with Christianity is not that it has been tried and found wanting, but that it has been found difficult and left untried." Christianity Today's editor-in-chief, Russell Moore, says something really provocative along these very same lines. He writes, "For too long, we have called unbelievers to invite Jesus into your life. But Jesus doesn't actually want to be in your life in the fullest sense. Your life's a wreck," says Moore. "Jesus calls you into his life." That's a really provocative thought, isn't it? One of my greatest hopes for you and for this church as you go forward in the days to come is that you will become or remain obsessed with Jesus. My final meditation to our staff last week was just talking about all the reasons to be obsessed with the wondrous life of Jesus and to seek to enter into that. That's my prayer for you. There's no life more beautiful. There's no life more influential, no life more needed in our world today than the love and the truth of Jesus. So keep trying out his truth. Keep applying the fundamental things that he says until it sets you free, until you find it changing your life in wonderful ways. And as you do this, and you find that difficult, and you will, and as you do this, and life is very difficult, and it will be at many points, when you find yourself driven to discouragement or despair at any point in the journey ahead of you, please remember this other fundamental thing, that grace is greater than the gravity of life. The grace of God is greater than the gravity of this life. I've talked a lot about that idea over the last couple of years through our Lift Initiative, so I'm not going to go over all of that again with you. I just encourage you to hold on to that idea and to trust the source of all grace, even when your grip is weak on him. He's always holding on to you. Last Friday night, not this past one, the week before, I was with more than 100 of our staff and their loved ones at a great celebration party for the beginning of the new year. And And I felt my phone buzzing, and you've had this happen to you at some point, and you look down and you see, oh, I need to answer that one. And the phone call was from my brother Jeff, who has been battling a very serious cancer, and who has been on hospice since Christmas, about which time he lost the use of his lower body. And I went outside to the next room, and he shared with me that he now lost the upper body, and he was scared, and he was in pain. And I felt sudden flashback to childhood. And I was the older brother, and my little brother was hurt and scared, and I couldn't do anything to fix it. And I completely lost myself. I completely melted down. I couldn't do anything but sob. And in the midst of this incredibly oppressive moment, the grace of God came to me. It came first in the form of my wife, Amy, who found me in the other room and wrapped her arms around me and just held me and just groaned with me. It came secondly in the form of Steve Carter, who came in and prayed with me. And you need to know this about him, about Steve. He is not just a great preacher. He is a good shepherd. And he shepherded. He was my pastor in that moment and will be henceforth at a time that I just desperately needed that kind of pastoring. He came to me in the form of Dave Melvin, who's up here as well. And he brought me an old-fashioned. And I don't know that was the most spiritual kind of ministry. But I will say that all these things felt like grace to me in that moment. And that grace has just continued. It's come from family members. It's washed around us as we've grieved with each other and love each other. I felt it from this amazing church family. And I'm trusting in Jesus for that precious brother of mine who, like our sister last summer, has gone beyond this world. I'm just trusting in Jesus and for the rest of our grieving family that there is a grace greater than the gravity of life. I'm daring to believe this. And I hope that you'll believe it. I hope you will hold on to that promise that God makes us. I hope you will trust it in whatever you're going through now or will face in the days to come, that His grace is greater than your sin, it's greater than your doubts, it's greater even than death itself. And by the power of Christ, either in this life or beyond the door, we will rise as He makes all things new, as Jesus makes everything new, as He has promised. I want to close today just by sharing some wisdom from one of my heroes, a man by the name of Max Dupree. Max was the CEO of the storied Herman Miller Furniture and Design Company. He preceded me a few decades ago as the chair of Fuller Seminary, and I will just tell you that in the congregation right out here is my great colleague, the former president of Fuller Seminary, Mark Laberton, who's joined us in worship today. And I so love him and appreciate him. But Max Dupree famously said that the first responsibility of a leader, whether in the home, the workplace, the church, or in the nation, and it's important to think of that as we approach this significant week, the very first importance is to define reality, to say what is true, to describe the fundamental things. And I guess that's what I've been trying to do through these years, and I hope I've done in a little way this morning again. I've wanted to describe the reality of life as it is and the God who is that meets us in the middle of this life and who calls us to apply these things that can be life-changing for us. And I hope that the Lord has used some things along the way that have been spoken from this platform to help grow His good in your life. But Max Dupree also says something about the last responsibility of a leader. And he says what a leader must do finally, is to say thank you. So I want to close by just saying thank you. I want to say thank you first to my wife, Amy, for being my long-suffering partner. suffering with me most of the time through all of these years, and for the extraordinary imprint you've left behind in these spaces through your beautiful gift of design. I don't know if you know that the colors and the furniture and all of that you see out there, it comes from her head. She chooses these things. She and her good friend Kathy have played a big role in shaping the environment here. And so many precious relationships, Amy, that you've invested in with people over the years, from kids in our confirmation class to women and others in our church. Thank you, sweetheart. Thank you for moving here in January from San Diego, a Californian. I want to say thank you to my three boys, our three boys, Rush, Cole, and Reed, for enduring what I know has been the challenge of being a PK. It's not an easy job. I was a politician's kid. That's a challenge. Preacher's kid, harder, I think, because so much of the time when you're growing up, your dad is away ministering to other people's kids, and other people's families, and holidays are never normal for you. Thank you guys for hanging in there, for not giving up on your dad, for loving me, encouraging me as you do. Thank you for becoming the amazing men you have become. Wow, I credit so much of that to your mom, but also to the student ministries and children's ministries of Christ Church as well for shaping these amazing guys. And Cole, thanks for marrying up and for the promise of a grandson in a couple of months. Heather, thank you for that special gift to our families. I also want to express my tremendous debt to the incredible staff of Christ Church. And I'll never again work with people at this level. I just know it. It's just, and that's part of why I feel so confident for your future. They are so strong. They are so committed to Christ and to you. Thank you to the Board of Trustees, who way back in 1996 gave me the chance to come here, and all the trustees who along the way, and many of them sitting right up here right now, who have so faithfully companioned me on the journey. I'm grateful to the elders, the massive group of lay leaders and volunteers who make this church, its ministry and mission happen week in and week out. People often say, I love your church. And I'm going, no, it's not my church. This is an amazing group of people. And I want to say, because of that, above all, thank you to you, Lord. Thank you for the inestimable privilege of serving you as a pastor for 40 years, most of it spent right here with this incredible group of people who do not consider this place someplace they just go to, but to these amazing people who are Christ Church. And so here's my final note at the door. Just remember this. These fundamental things apply. As time goes by, goodbye.